What's up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back. This is The Deep Corner, presented by the Volleyball League of America, episode 45. I'm Rob St. Clair, and a very special guest joins the show today. He is a three-time collegiate first-team All-American. He is a 2008 Olympic gold medalist, and more recently, the host of the CrossNet Volleyball podcast, Mr. Ryan Millar. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rob. Good to be with you. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks for hopping on. Excited about what you're doing with your show over it and the CrossNet guys. I had Don Shujo on lately, one of your fellow CrossNet athletes, and that was a super great episode.
Very but cool.
I figured, like, as much as I've loved your show, you deserve a chance to be interviewed for once instead of be doing the interviewing. So I'm excited for this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I'm interviewing people, I'm not really talking. So, you know, I add some perspective, you know, but based on my experiences, but most of the time I'm just trying to get to know the personalities in the volleyball world, because they're pretty interesting. So,
well, yeah, I'm a big fan of your show. You've got a lot of great guests that have already come out and several more for the future, as you were just telling me, but let's get to know Ryan Millar, the volleyball player, a little bit more than the podcast host.
Okay.
So I was thinking about, like, a format that you and I have both done a lot is just, like, get a person on and kind of start from the beginning of their volleyball career, like when they first start touching a ball, high school, college recruitment, pros, whatever that's looked like for each individual person, and different stories for everyone, which is what's so cool about it. But yours in particular, there's so much going on there. You've been so many places in the world of volleyball that I kind of wanted to pick a couple stops along the way and dig into them a little deeper. So for the people that don't already know Ryan's background, you should. And if not, then you can just do your own little bit of research and figure it out. But I wanted to start with your time at BYU in college. So you started in 96. And back in 96, BYU men's volleyball was not what it is now. Like, for the entire time that I've been following college volleyball, BYU's been pretty much a perennial championship threat with very few exceptions, but that didn't used to be the case. So between the time that you got there and the time that you left in 1999, you had won three individual All-American honors, and you won a national championship in 99, the first for the program. So there was a lot of growth for the program that happened there and has kind of become what a lot of us know it to be now. So looking back on your college days, what do you think were some of the things, or the steps along the way that happened during your college career for the BYU program?
You know, Carl McGowan, who was our coach, I think he had a master plan around what the BYU volleyball program could potentially look like. You know, it was easier said than done, because BYU is not an easy place to recruit to. It's a religious school. It's kind of a niche school. It's in the middle of Provo, Utah, which is not near the beach in Southern California. It's not in Hawaii. You know, it's just a really tough school to get good players to come play at. And so I remember Carl sent me a letter once after I'd already graduated and we'd won, and he went on this journey of becoming this perennial program. And he's like, you know, there were a few days in my coaching career that I could point at that really defined it. And one of them was the day that you told me that you were going to come to BYU to play, because I was the first, you know, I was one of the top recruits in the nation coming out of high school. I could have really picked to go anywhere. And I chose BYU. And I think Carl saw that as kind of a huge piece of the puzzle that he was trying to create. My freshman year, we weren't very good, but we were really young. I want to say we started five freshmen.
Wow.
So, I mean, I knew that we were going to be good. And then Carl masterfully put together this coaching staff that became, I don't know if he knew this, but it eventually became world class, because, I mean, we had Carl, who was largely considered one of the best volleyball minds in the entire world, leading the program, teaching us how to play volleyball the right way and developing our skills in a way that I think a lot of guys just weren't getting at other places. And then we had Hugh McCutcheon as our assistant coach, who, you know, just went on to be this international powerhouse, gold medal winning coach with us in Beijing. Then he goes on and wins the silver with women in London. Now he's completely dominating the NCAA by turning the whole program around at University of Minnesota.
In the Big Ten.
I mean, just a brilliant volleyball mind. Yeah, seriously. Taking a program like Minnesota that was kind of middle of the pack before and now is a perennial Final Four team. And it's no surprise because he's just his volleyball mind is perfect. The way he is able to get people to buy into the right system and things like that. He's just a master at that. But that, it didn't stop there, because then we had Troy Tanner, who's a gold medal Olympian himself, a phenomenal volleyball mind technician. He brought his skills to that team. And then it didn't even stop there, because we also had Rob Browning. And Rob Browning is an amazing volleyball mind as well. I mean, he was on our staff in multiple Olympic games. Now he's a longtime head coach at the University of St. Mary's for the women's program. I mean, just a brilliant, brilliant guy himself. And that was our coaching staff. And you know, when I look back on it now, I think at that time, we probably took a lot of it for granted because we didn't really know what the future was going to dictate for each one of us laying forward. But you look back on it now and you're just like, holy cow, like there's no wonder why we were so successful. I mean, Carl just put together this beast that continued on even after I left. And we kind of, I think guys like myself and Ossie Antonetti and Hector LeBron and Mac Wilson and Steve Hines and the guys that were there in 99 when we won, I think we all have a sense of pride in regards to what the program has developed into now. You know, you talked about them being in the national championship picture kind of year after year after year. And this year is no different. I mean, right. They're going into the Final Four. I mean, I went and saw him play against USC, one of the last matches in the regular season. And I was just like, dude, these guys, they're going to be tough to beat. I mean, I know other teams are good, but
this year, Gabby Garcia Fernandez
from the service line,
right?
Those guys can really, I mean, they'll rattle off points from the service line. And if you can rattle off points from the service line and score real points, you're really tough to beat.
And, yeah. And men's
they've got a lot of guys back there. Yeah, totally. So I don't know that to me, that's kind of how I would answer that question about how it all kind of came together. You know, before I came to BYU, BYU was kind of an up and coming program. I would probably say they had a couple of years where they were in the top five and they were grinding out some good years, but you know, they never really, really were in the national title picture until we were able to put together the run that we did in 99, which was obviously pretty special. That team was pretty special. So,
well, players like yourself and all the guys that you just rattled off, I was going to bring up guys like Ossie Antonetti, Hector LeBron, like that's, that certainly helps a coaching staff. Yeah. As brilliant as McGowan and his whole family has been for the BYU program for years, that
you gotta have Rich Lamborn on that team as well. Don't forget another gold medalist. So I mean, that we were pretty stacked. So
Richie is a guy I'd like to have on the show one of these days, because he's
a good interview,
fascinating volleyball story too, he knows a thing or two about volleyball podcasting, obviously.
So
I wanted to ask specifically, you're talking about just the way that Carl built the program and the way that the McGowans and really their family to this day still has their fingerprints all over BYU volleyball. Is there some secret to the way that you personally and your team in college was taught how to block the ball? Because something about BYU's statistical blocking numbers year after year after year are just unbelievable. Like, and even just based on the eye test, like watching the discipline with which you guys triple block, the moves that your middles make, the way that they all read the game, the space that they take up is really impressive. There's got to be some little secret recipe to that, and if you can't share it, you can't share it. But what do you think was part of that for Carl and for, you know, the program ever since? Because there's definitely something about that for BYU culture.
Yeah. You know, Carl was the master technician. He was able to diagnose the absolute right way to play the game. And blocking was a huge part of that. And I know for me personally, when I came to BYU, I was a good blocker in high school, but I didn't know the true essence of and technicality of being a really good middle blocker and what that entailed. If you were to ask me, what are some of the most beneficial or the most beneficial trait to have as a middle, the answer would probably be to be able to read the game really well, because when I was at BYU, we instilled a read and react type of blocking system. And to be a middle at that level and doing what we were doing, you had to be really good at being able to read the game and reacting to what was happening. And so We spent a lot of time on that. I remember deliberate amounts of practice where, you know, we would be testing our reaction time to certain plays and certain instances and certain situations. And we had to learn quickly on how to read things really well. And you combine that with his ability to put together the other core aspects of blocking, which are footwork, eye work, and hand work. I think that's what you see. And it's no wonder that it's continued on, because, you know, after Carl, then Chris McGowan came on and kind of continued that legacy of discipline and reading and reacting and being really good with footwork and hand work and eye work. And then Sean Olmstead comes in, and who's also another, you know, kind of disciple of Carl, having gone through the program himself and being around Carl as much as he has. I think he just continues it. And, you know, I look at their team this year and they're very physical. They're just, it's a big team. They have a lot of big guys. Their middles are both big. They've got big outsides. Gabby's big. I mean, the only guy that's not really big is Will, their setter, but he plays big.
Right.
And so it's a pretty special team. And when I, in 99, when I was playing, it was myself and Mac Wilson in the middle, and we're both big. I mean, Mac's taller than I am by a couple inches. And so, I always tell people you can't teach tall. So
I've been saying that for years.
Yeah. You can teach a lot of things, but you can't teach height. So, you know, that helps a little bit as well. BYU is always kind of known as being kind of a physical type of team, big guys that are able to do a lot of the core basic skills really well. And you put that together, and typically that's a pretty good recipe for success, particularly at a level like the college level, where you might be playing other teams that don't have as big of guys. And that means that they're going to have to do something a little bit better, which becomes really difficult, because as the game gets better, as the level gets better, the margin between your skill and the next guy's skill becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. And so the question then becomes, what am I going to develop today that is going to allow me to be better than that guy? And I just think what Carl put in place that still lives on today was a recipe for success.
That's very well said. As the level increases, the margin between individual player skill sets and teams and all that, the attention to detail becomes that much more important. I point that out on the mic all the time when I commentate matches. Like a couple of weeks ago in the VLA, we did this, and the margin of error between a 3-0 and an 0-3 is incredibly narrow. And just the discipline with which teams make these tiny little touches and all the detail related to blocking, defense, serve, receive, all that little stuff is massive. And you made a point there about the level of reading ability and the game sense you have to have as a middle blocker. Like I was a middle back in the day, not nearly at that high of a level, but I appreciate what it takes to play the position. How much of that, like the preparedness required to read the game at that high of a level, how much of it comes from scouting a team beforehand versus reading the situation in the moment? What's the balance between those two things in your experience?
You know, the strategic aspects of volleyball, the scouting, the knowing the competition, things like that, that exists and it's helpful. But in the end, it's what you're able to do once you step on the court. You know, the scouting is going to take you so far in regards to understanding what certain teams do in certain rotations, how a setter likes to set balls when he or she is in certain places. And that's all kind of going on in the back of your head. But in the end, it's more about your ability to fall back on your experience. That's why, you know, the best players in the world typically are guys that have been around a little while, even though there might be some better athletes that are younger. But typically the best players in the world are guys that have been around for 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years, because they've gone through the rigors of kind of seeing everything. And it's true. I mean, once you kind of know what's going to happen, the game does start to slow down a little bit for you. And that becomes so helpful in the game of volleyball because it's so fast, right?
So
you've got
fast.
All these people coming at you at the same time. And it's like, well, how do you process all of that information in the amount of time that it requires you to actually make the right move and do it the right way so that you can set yourself up in a way that you can potentially be successful? that takes time. I mean, generally, you don't see a young player come out and just immediately dominate the game, because it takes time to know the ins and outs of how to play and what to look at and what to follow with your eyes. And I don't want to be too jumpy here so that I can get over there. And there, all of that's that, the amount of information that's being processed by a middle blocker to me is pretty astronomical.
It's staggering. It's crazy.
And it's happening in like a split second too. That it would be really interesting to like throw some electrodes on someone like Max Holt, or like, you know what I mean, or someone else that's really good in the world, and just see how many things are firing at once, and what makes a successful move and what doesn't. So like, why did they make the wrong move on this play but made the right move on this play, and analyze. There's somebody out there that loves to just, that loves data and analytics. And I think it'd be really interesting to figure that out someday.
That's all so well said. I totally agree. And that like the average, like absolute world-class middle is older than the average world-class player at maybe some other positions. I think you're absolutely right about that, because it takes a certain amount of time to really understand the game at that high of a level. Rarely do you see like a 23-year-old middle blocker like considered in the top five in the world at that position as much as you do an opposite or a left side, or even a setter. Like sometimes like Micah Christensen, for example, comes out at age 21 is in that conversation right away, but that almost never happens for middles. So I'm glad that you broke it down that way. It's really cool. So after college, this which was 99 for you, you guys won the national championship. Very interesting timing of everything in your world and in the world of volleyball at that time, because the Olympics were coming up in the year 2000. And I don't think I knew exactly when this happened until today, but when like that, the 2000 Olympics in Sydney were the first time really that a match was rally scoring to 25 points and that the libero position existed. Like I knew in my head that change had to have happened at some point, but I didn't know when it was. So it happened to be right as really you were making the transition to the national team. So what was that all like? Because learning that high of a level is a change in itself, but like literally changes in the rules of the game is something completely different.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the FIVB made those rule changes. I think it was in 98. Because I know the first major tournament was the 98 World Championships. And of course, the college game at that time. So in 99, we were still using the old school rules.
Right. It takes a couple years.
So when I went to the national team. Right. So I went to the national team and there was the new rules. And so I had to adjust to that, of course. I think back on it now and I'm like, and I think back on my time on the national team, almost 15 years on the national team. And I'm thinking, how hard would it be for someone to come right out of college and try to make an Olympic team the next, you only have a year, and be a starter too. And I'm like, that would be hard to do. The reason why I say that is because you've got established guys that have been on the team a long time. And if a new guy comes in, then they have to be significantly better than guys that have been on the team for an established amount of time. When I did it, I tell people that there was a level of kind of blissful ignorance, because I didn't know any different. I just wanted to go play volleyball. You know what I mean? I didn't know that there was a hierarchy. I didn't know that guys were jockeying for positions to go get overseas jobs. I was just like, look, I'm just going to come in here and play volleyball. And luckily enough, I was good enough to make an impact and be able to solidify a spot that I think normally would be really, really difficult to do. And so, ignorance is bliss, right? As they say in the Matrix, right? Mr. Smith said that to Neo, I think. Ignorance is bliss. And so that's kind of how it was. And then I quickly kind of like, I learned a little bit more about that as I got going. I'm like, oh, like I'm taking this guy's spot who's been on the team for 11 years. And so that's kind of a big deal. But you know, it is what it is. It's look, I had to deal with the same things when I started getting a little bit older as well. I had young talent coming in. They're nipping at my heels. And I'm thinking, geez, like, what do I need to do every day to ensure that I can stay at the level that I need to stay at and solidify this spot that I've had for so long? And to me, that's kind of a fun part of competition, right? It's like, if you can't be excited about that grind, then you're in the wrong occupation.
Well said. And Sujo said a similar thing on the show. It was funny. He came into the national team program out of USC and was like, oh yeah, I'm going to walk in the gym, I'm going to play volleyball, and I'm going to be the guy, not knowing really who Loy Ball was at the time and like what, just how it all worked. And he figured it out pretty quickly. But it's funny to hear that, because like, I'm sure back then it wasn't as immediately accessible, or like you didn't know the internal situation in the national team until you're in the gym. Maybe nowadays, right, it's a little bit easier to put those pieces together, but you're right. Coming out of college and making an Olympic team, even making an Olympic team, but starting on one the next year is incredibly difficult to do. I can't really think of any other recent cases, at least for the US, that's been done.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, it's and this hasn't changed, but the talent pool with the USA pipeline is pretty deep. So you got a lot of guys in the gym that have been there a while, that are fighting for spots. And look, everyone wants to go to the Olympics. Everyone wants to make rosters. Everyone wants to travel with the team. And so, because the more you do that, the better jobs you get overseas. And so, I don't know. I just feel fortunate enough that I was able to come in and make the impact that I was and was able to. And then, you know, have Doug Beal, who was our coach at that time, had the foresight to be like, because I'm assuming he was thinking the same thing. Well, you got this young college guy coming in. What kind of impact is he going to make? But to his credit, you know, being able to be willing to see, hey, this is different. This is going to impact the team. This is somebody that can actually have a bright future with USA Volleyball. He's going to help us in these Olympics. If I wouldn't have been that guy, believe me, Doug wouldn't have put me in that position. He's a good enough coach to know what was going to be best for the team. Look, we go to Sydney and we completely poop the bed. We didn't play well at all, but it's still the Olympic Games. And so,
right.
You know, it was a stepping stone in the journey, exactly, of trying to get to where we eventually got in Beijing. So,
yep, you took the words right out of my mouth. That performance in Sydney, like you can look back on it now and almost laugh at it, knowing what happened 8 years later. But before we get to that, I think I talked to Loy about this one of the times he's been on the show, and I thought it was interesting because I've been following international volleyball for a long time, but I've obviously never played at that level. So, of the big three tournaments, this not including like World League or what is now VNL. So you take World Championships, World Cup, and the Olympic Games. Which one do you think is the most difficult to win and why?
The most difficult tournament, this is an easy question to answer. The most difficult tournament is World Championships. It's the easiest question that you could ask me, because people might be surprised that I don't say the Olympics, but I'm honestly, World Championships is more difficult to win than the Olympics. The reason why I say that is because in the Olympics, you have continental entries.
That's right.
So every continent has an entry. So there's a team from Africa, there's a team from Asia, there's a team from North America, South America, Europe, multiple teams. Then you got all the wild card teams. And it's a good tournament and all the best teams are there because you have to qualify. But World Championships is different because you've got all the best teams are at World Championships.
There are what, 40 of them, 30 of them, like an unbelievable.
It's a massive tournament.
Yeah,
and you've got typically in every quad, every 4 years leading up to Olympics, at every Olympic Games, you've got three or four or five potential top 10 teams that aren't even in the Olympics.
That's right. Serbia,
because they didn't qualify.
Year. Right. Yeah. And right. It's usually European teams
European teams
get the short end.
Maybe some South American teams, you know, and whatever, you know what I mean? But in World Champs, all those teams are there.
Right.
So it's the best of the best of the best. And so, and then the tournament format is just an absolute grind as well. Cause it's like,
how long is it? Like a month? It's gotta be
it's like
crazy.
A month pretty much. Cause you go to one place, you play against three teams cause you're in a pool of four or five or whatever. Then you got to make it out of that pool. Then you go to another pool and you got to play four or five new better teams. Then you make it out of that pool and you go to another pool that has even better teams. And by the end, you're just exhausted. And it's a really tough tournament. I mean, look at all the success we've had as a program, and World Champs has always been a really tough area for us. I don't think I've ever placed super well in all the World Championships that I've played in. And it's just, it's a grind.
Yeah. It's like, if you took all of European Champions League instead of across a whole season, you put it all in like a month. It's right. Kind of the same number of teams and number of matches. It's pretty outrageous. And yeah. Loy said the same thing. At least he said the same thing about the Olympics actually maybe being the easiest, for the exact reasons that you said, because there are only 12 teams there. And really, like, there are a couple of them that you can, and not that you would ever admit to doing this, but you can really overlook, for example, this year, Tunisia and the third South American team, Venezuela, maybe. There are a few teams that just don't have a chance to win the Olympics. Then you win your couple matches and pools in the Olympics, and it's good enough to get to the quarterfinals, and then it starts getting serious. But you're right. In World Champs, it's serious the whole time. But a dark horse one that I wanted to ask about is World Cup, because that format is even wackier in that there's no playoffs at all. It's just a round robin of 12 teams where you play 11 matches and that's it. So like when the U.S. men's team won that in 2015 to grab the bid to Rio, that was a big achievement, because you just have 11 matches. And if you screw up and lose one of them, that might be it for your chances to win that tournament. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a different type of beast, but you're absolutely right. I remember in 2007, right before Beijing was World Cup.
Was it in Tokyo always, like it still is?
It was in Japan, yeah. And we start off playing really well. I mean, we were rolling pretty good. I think we felt pretty good. We felt like our chances were really good to qualify there. And we ended up losing to Puerto Rico.
Wow, I knew that.
I think it was the day after we'd just beaten Brazil 3-0. So we beat Brazil 3-0, and then we lose to Puerto Rico 3-1. We didn't play well. They careered. And what was really interesting was, I mean, they were super pumped up because it was like the first time that Puerto Rico had beaten the U.S. in like 35 years or something like that in a major competition. And but the sad part for them was that actually knocked us out of not finishing in the top three to qualify. Whereas if we would have, then we wouldn't have been in the continental qualification where we knocked them out.
You had to beat
so they possibly could have gone to the Olympics, but by beating us, they actually knocked themselves out. And then we played them again in the qualifier and just dominated and just crushed them down. And so you talk to some of those guys like Piki Soto and some of those other guys, and I think they'd probably tell that story a little bit different, the Puerto Rican guys. So,
wow, that's a great point. Because yeah, like if you don't qualify from the top two or three spots in World Cup or whatever it is, then you have to go through the continent.
You got to win your continent, right?
And I know for a fact that every other team in the Norseca region hopes and prays that the U.S. finishes top two or three at World Cup, so they don't have to deal with you all. Canada's been riding that fact for the last two Olympics.
Canada, Cuba, Puerto Rico, those three teams typically 100%. Are the ones.
Wow, that's amazing. So yeah, Puerto Rico may have really killed their own chance.
They shot themselves in the foot big time. They didn't know it at the time, but they should have.
Imagine getting penalized for playing really well and winning a match. That's funny. So that's a pretty good segue, because you're talking about World Cup leading into 2008. And even though you didn't get your bid to Beijing through World Cup, you obviously did through the Norseca qualifier. And then that summer before the Beijing Olympics, you guys go out and win the World League. And the World League is an interesting tournament now, Volleyball Nations League, because like some teams don't ever send their top team. Some teams, like you, for example, in 2009 took the year off that summer and didn't play World League. Like, I totally understand that. So World League means something a little bit different in every year, but I'm sure this year and like your year in 08, it's very much like in kind of an Olympic warm-up situation. Right. So when you guys won that tournament, how much of an impact do you think it had on what eventually would happen in Beijing later that summer?
I think it had a big impact, actually. First of all, the U.S. had never won World League at that point.
That's true.
And so that was a big deal for us. The crazy thing about all of that is we actually ended up losing our first match in the World League finals, like really bad to Serbia. They played great. We played horrible. And then we go into the second match against really good Polish team, and we barely scratch out a 3-2 win. In fact, they had a swing to win the match, and we soft blocked it, and then Reed ended up turning it in transition, and we ended up winning that match. Awesome. If we'd have lost to Poland, we would have been gone. It would have been 1-2 barbecue.
I assume that's in like the final six format that they still do now. So you kind of got
exactly right.
Two other teams.
And that was down in Brazil.
Yeah.
And so we beat Poland, and that gives us enough to go on and play against Brazil in the semis. And we just crushed them. We beat them 3-0 and in Brazil, packed house. It was awesome. Right.
That
we played great.
Incredible.
We talk about Beijing, and I know I am friends with a lot of those guys, 'cause I played with a few of them professionally, and I'd be interested to ask them what their mindset was coming in against us in the finals of Beijing, because they did not match up well against us. They beat all their other teams regularly, like pretty easy. But they always struggled against us. We just matched up really well against them for some reason. But
you could tell that by the way that the gold medal match in Beijing went down.
Yeah, they kind of panicked a little bit.
They panicked. They had some really weird lineup situations. They had three outside hitters with one of them kind of rotating and playing opposite. It was very odd. So you're exactly right.
Yeah.
And so now in Beijing, or maybe before, what do you think was the point, maybe for you personally or for the whole team, that the idea of winning that gold medal was a reality in your head? Like it was a thing that was very attainable. Was it years before? Was it after you were already standing on the podium? Was it when you drew Brazil in the finals? Was it like after you survived like a 20-year-old Maxim Mikhailov in the semis or whatever it was? When was that for you?
Hugh was really good that whole quad at making sure that there was real clarity around the vision for our team. He told us that we were going to win the Olympics and we were going to be the best team in the world, more than I'd ever heard a coach say that, because it's kind of a bold thing to say, right?
If you say it so many times, you start to believe it, I guess.
Yeah. And then you start kind of like, yeah, we're pretty good and maybe we can do this. You go into the Olympics and there's a lot of hope, and you hope that you can go out and execute. We knew we were good. World League helped. The finals and winning there helped, and we felt confident. The first match, we come out and we just steamroll Venezuela. We go up 2-0. I think the first two sets are like 18-18. I mean, we're just rolling them.
No problem. Yeah.
And then they come back. And they start playing really good. And we're like, what is going on? They push us to the fifth set in our first match. And we're like, man, what is going on? And, luckily we put it together and we're able to finish them off. But then we played some pretty good teams in our pool, like Italy and Bulgaria, who were both pretty good. And we ended up playing really well. And I'm thinking, man, we're playing at a high level again. Problem is that we just match up from a crossover standpoint in Beijing. It was really tough for us because, in the quarters we get Serbia, who just beat us in the World League finals, but then we had to beat in the finals. So we ended up beating Serbia in the actual final game in World League. And they just always played us really tough. And so that was a really, really tight match. In fact, we went down 2-1 in that match and had to come back and push them to 5 and ended up making some really good plays in that quarterfinal match.
That was the David Lee match, wasn't it? Like really his coming out party, or was that the Russia match? I can't remember.
That was the Russia match when Dave kind of put his stamp on that game. But, we win against Serbia and then we got to get the Russians, and we're like the exact opposite of Brazil against us with the Russians. Like we don't match up good against them. And
still true to this day, we did, honestly.
We didn't have a lot of success against them at all in major tournaments. And so we knew that was going to be a grind. Come to find out that Clay Stanley serves the ball really hard. And And those first two sets against Russia, I've never seen anybody serve the ball harder than Clay did. I mean, the Russians didn't know what to do. Their libero was like looking at their coach, like, what do you want us to do? I think he had like 10 aces in the first two sets. He completely dominated the match in those first two sets from the service line. I was at the net, you know, I'm just ready to block. And it was like ace. And then they did high ball. And then we get a free ball. We transition ace. And, but you know, Russia being as good as they were at that time, they pushed us back and took us to that fifth set. And then at the end of that fifth set is when Dave kind of took over. He had like a kill, a block, a kill, then a block. And that was the match.
It's gotta be fun for even though you weren't on the court at the time, watching another middle have that amount of an impact on a match.
Yeah.
It's rare.
Yeah. It was really fun to watch. It was really cool. Yeah, it was, he put together a nice string and, you know, kudos to Deloy too, to know where to go with the ball. And, Dave made a really nice blocking move on their middle. They have a 7-foot middle. His name's Volkov, and who's, you know,
Loy, hitting the ball wherever he wanted. Loy described Volkov as the scariest blocker he's ever played against. And I don't blame him.
He's got these really long but skinny arms because he's, you know, he's 7 feet tall and he just still gets plays. Over the net super
he's still huge. There. Yeah, he's still on Zenit Kazan this year.
I can imagine. But Dave stuffed him really hard back into his face, and then Dave hit a ball straight down. And then of course there's the last point when Dave just make a really nice move to Mikhailov. Look, everybody knew it was going to Mikhailov, but it didn't matter because we knew the whole match that they were going to set him all the time. We still couldn't stop him. So, and he made a great move and he stuffed him. And then at that point you're thinking like, holy cow, like, we're going to go compete for a gold medal. And I think if you really wanted me to nail down a time, it's probably when that ball goes down that I think, man, we've got a real shot at taking this and being Olympic champions. And so, but you know, Brazil's no easy game. And so we were pretty focused going into that game as well. And that was a fun match too.
Of course it was. It actually just resurfaced on YouTube recently.
Yeah.
Like the Olympics.
Yeah, and high def too.
Yeah, which it looks good.
I hadn't seen in high def. It was awesome that someone posted that.
The commentator is awful because it wasn't Barnett and Sunderland from the American broadcast. Right. It was like the international one. So that was tough. But the match was amazing. I watched all of it. It was great to relive that.
It's funny that they get these British commentators and there's like zero volleyball in the UK. So it's like, I don't know.
Is it
an accent thing or what? But
thank you, Ryan. I think we need some powerful people to get that problem fixed a little bit.
I remember the NBC footage when Sunderland was doing the commentary and it was awesome. In fact, I can still hear his voice when the last ball goes down. And
I believe it was, that'll do it. Yeah.
And that'll do it. And then he says something about Hugh and, you know, all the things that happened to Hugh during those Olympics. And he obviously was well aware of all of that. And you know, Sunderland's, he's got a big stake in USA Volleyball being a part of the program and winning a gold medal himself. And so I think he was feeling a little bit of those emotions kind of coming back up and knowing that we were back on top of the world and
understandable.
What winning a gold medal does for the program moving forward and things like that. So.
Yeah, very big moment. I wish I could get a chance to tell Paul that he's basically the reason why I commentate matches now and like the biggest like direct style influence in the way I do it. He's the man, and I would like to thank him for that at some point. And maybe we can make that happen.
He'd be a cool interview. I should try to reach out to him.
I would love that very much. Him and Barnett both would be awesome guys to talk to.
Yeah.
Barnett's from my area. I live in Chicago. He's from around here.
Oh, cool.
So I want to talk about your club career a little bit. Because it just so happens that right now in like late April that we're recording this, so there's actually about to be a ton of volleyball played. And first and foremost is this weekend, the finals of Champions League featuring your old club, Trentino. So, which is very cool. Do you have them winning that match or do you have the Polish team as Zaxa?
Oh, man. Zaxa is, they've kind of been surprising the whole year and been dominant. Trento's tough. It's in Italy, which I think probably gives them a little bit of a push, even though the Polish fans will travel. I've never seen anything like Polish fans before. It's the way they love volleyball in Poland is aspiring.
Exactly.
I loved playing there. I played there for a year as well. I played for a team called Rzeszów, Rzeszowia, and the fans were amazing where and I played there as well. And so there'll be a fair amount of Polish fans there, but being in Italy, I think probably tips the nod a little bit in Trento's favor, but I expect it to be a pretty good match.
I agree. I co-host a show on the European channels where I had to pick this same thing. And I did pick Trento just because I think the matchup's going to be so good. And yeah. Zoxa's unbelievable, but like they're
good. They got
right. Our boy Dave Smith playing for him.
Yeah.
But like,
yeah, good for Dave.
Trento's strengths are they're much better at what they're good at than Zoxa is. And what Zoxa is really good at, Trentino is closer. Was kind of my assessment, if that makes any sense.
Interesting.
But anyway, so Loy talked about the differences in the different places that he played internationally. And I'm wondering the same thing from you, because you spent a lot of like the prime of your career in Italy. And then you went to Turkey. Yeah. You went to Poland in Rzeszów, like you said, for a year. And then you went to Lokomotiv in Russia at the very tail end of it. Right. So those countries have very different volleyball styles. Could you like put your finger on a couple of the key differences from place to place?
When I went to Italy, when I first started playing overseas, Italy was the league. I mean,
right.
All the best players were playing there. It was the best league by far. All the best teams, all the best players from all around the world were playing in Italy. And so from a development standpoint, from a volleyball standpoint, those 7 years I played in Italy were really helpful in my development as a player. It's always interesting going over there. You know, you got a new coach who's got a new philosophy on how to do things, and you kind of have your way. And so you got to work through all of that. Plus you're in a new country and you're meeting new players and trying to deal with living overseas, speaking different languages. So from a developmental standpoint, Italy was really, really great. Just being able to kind of get a feel for what true like European style of volleyball was like, the discipline of European volleyball, kind of the structure of how technical they are. You're in the US, it's more about the grind and the grit. In Italy, it's more about like fine tuning the really small little details. And we did that a lot in Italy, and I had a lot of good, interesting coaches that I think instilled a lot of different things in me from a technical standpoint, which really helped me in my career. From there, then I go to Turkey, which was like completely opposite, but it was kind of an up and coming league, right? The coaching is really not great. At least I wasn't going to learn much in Turkey, but I was going to have a lot of fun. So I got to use a lot of what I learned in Italy and now kind of have fun in the game again. And the team that I played for was kind of a middle of the pack type of team normally. And I go my first year and we end up winning the championship, and they'd never won the championship before. So it was like a huge deal for them. And I just had so much fun playing over there. Turkey was such an interesting place to live, and the volleyball wasn't quite as high, but it was still really good because Turkey was kind of an up and coming league. The money was getting better and better and better, and look, good players follow good money. And so
yes, they
started getting better and better international talent. The Turkish national team and the Turkish players were getting better. And so the 2 years that I spent in Istanbul were some of my favorite, actually. Then from there, I go on to Poland. And again, the volleyball is like a religion in Poland. So that was really fun. I was able to play with some guys that I'd competed against for a long, long time and got to know them personally. And it was just the Polish league, again, at that time was kind of an up and coming league. The money was starting to get better there too. So more players were starting to go there, and it's turned into kind of the league it is now, right? Which is one of the best leagues.
And, definitely top three for sure. If they had like an Italian or Russian level of money, it would be the best league on the planet by far, just because of the culture. Like like exactly what you're saying. I've said this on the show before, but the men's national team US likes to come and play VNL or World League here in the either in Chicago or in the near suburbs. And I've been to a bunch of those games, and sometimes if we're playing Poland, I go to those games and as an American fan, I'm outnumbered 50-1. It's absolutely outrageous. So you know it very well, but that's how they consume volleyball in Poland. It's so like enviable. It's what I want here.
It's massive. You know, I played in Poland with the national team where the facility that we're playing at was like more than sold out. And then outside they put up the huge big screen and they'll have 10,000 people outside even that can't get in the arena watching on the big screen. And it's just a huge kind of national party. And they do it right. They really do. And the league is no different. The fan support is amazing. Our gym was packed every night. In fact, our practices would be packed with full of people, just practice.
Wow, that's amazing too.
It was nuts. And so that makes it really exciting to play. Every night was super exciting and it was fun. The level was really good there too. And then from there I went and played in Russia, and Russia is another beast all on its own. It's from a volleyball standpoint, the level in Russia was way better than any place I'd ever seen. Just the amount of talent the Russians have is crazy to even comprehend. It's like we'd go to a gym and there'd be another 7-foot guy that jumped, you know, 40 inches and hits the ball 100,000 miles an hour. And I'd be like, who is this guy? And they're like, oh, that's that person. And then we go the next week and there's this new 7-foot guy. And I'm just like, dude, how many 7-foot guys you have that can jump 40 inches? And they're like, oh, we got a lot of them. And I'm just like, you guys are, this is nuts.
It's crazy.
But it really is. Yeah, it was crazy. But that year we had, my team in Novosibirsk was really good. We had a bunch of national team guys. We had the national team setter now, national team outside hitter.
Did you play with Marcus libero. Nilsson at all? Or did you?
No, he was him? A little bit, he was either before or after me. But our opposite was actually a Cuban guy that had dual citizenship. His mom was Russian. His dad was Cuban. And, so he got to play as a Russian, even though he was Cuban.
Didn't count against the foreign limit. That's huge.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that was really cool. Cause he was a great guy, but a phenomenal talent. I mean, we'd do the Vertec and he would jump up and touch 12 feet cold. So he'd hit these crazy angles all over the place, hammers, jump serve, super fun guy to play with. And then we had a Slovakian outside hitter who was also a great guy. I think still plays there actually. Lukas Divish is his name.
Oh yeah. I know Divish. He was there for a long time.
Yeah, he was. He's a good dude. Great teammate as well. Worked really hard. Yeah. So we had a good team. We did really well in Champions League and that was really fun because it got us out of Siberia for a while. We got to go to Paris and we got to go back to Italy. And so that was a fun year, but it was a grind playing in Russia though. We our coach practiced us a little bit. I mean, we played a lot of volleyball, but.
So of all those cool places that you were able to go like and make money, like legitimate, real professional athlete money playing volleyball, would you have had the money been equal or slightly less, taken it to play in the US?
Yeah. Oh yeah, easily.
And do you think you think every other American would say the same thing?
Yeah, I remember I was listening to Micah who's on a podcast and the podcast, another volleyball podcast, and they're like, how much money would it take to get you to stay in the US? And he's like, you know, it'd have to be a lot. They're like 50%. And he's like, ooh, yeah, I don't know. Maybe.
Wow. If that's not out of the question, then we at the VLA have a number to set our minds on. Wow.
You know, I don't know how much Micah's making. I'm assuming it's, you know, fairly good amount of money, but
better be. He's worth it.
Yeah, he's a great, great player. And so, you know, Modena is not known to be super, super high paying, but, you know, he wouldn't have gone there unless they put the right deal together for him. So he's not stupid and he's probably got his agent looking out for him. He's probably got offers coming from everywhere, but yeah, if I'm making the same amount of money or even a little less easily, that's a no-brainer. We'd stay in the U.S.
Well, that's the goal. Give us a few years, and hopefully we'll be able to make that a reality. That would be really nice.
That would be really cool.
The guys deserve it. They really do. It's such a grind going overseas, going wherever. Like I talked to Eric Shoji kind of recently, and like they had to fly 3 hours to play home games.
Yeah,
their home arena was 3 hours away from where they lived and practiced. It's outrageous.
Yep.
So you have a little segment on your show where you do kind of a couple sort of rapid fire, get to know you sorts of things. And I have the same thing. So flip the script and you get to go through that a little bit. So just first quick couple things that come into your head. Ready?
Okay.
All right. Early mornings or late nights?
Oh, I'm a morning person.
That's, I can't possibly get that through my head. That's like a foreign language to me.
I am not a nighttime person. If it's night, I want to sleep. If it's morning, I want to wake up.
What's your favorite music to listen to pregame, like a song or an artist or a genre?
Oh, man. You know, I like things when I was playing. I like things with a beat. Sometimes I get a little too amped up, and I actually like classical piano. Like, I'm a huge Chopin fan. And so sometimes I'll throw on some classical piano just to kind of calm me down, but get me into a little bit of a groove. So, but whether it's like good hip hop, like maybe Jay-Z or something, or like something a little bit rocky, like, I don't know. If I want to get amped up, I'll probably throw on some Metallica or something.
Love that. I've got the guitars on the wall behind me. You can, tell that I relate. What's the best day of the week?
I don't know. I mean, you can't beat Friday. It's just, there's something about Friday. It's just, I mean, I work in management consulting now, and Friday means it's the end of the work week. And so you get to look forward to the weekend, and it's kind of like the only day of the week when you actually have something to look forward to, I think. Cause you know what I mean? If it's Saturday, then you're looking forward to Sunday, and then you're like, but Sunday's close to Monday. So, I bet a lot of people say Friday. So I'll say Friday.
Good answer. Stuff block or service ace?
Oh, I'm a middle, so it's all about the block.
Good answer.
I care less about the ace.
Best post-game meal?
Oh, man. One of the benefits of playing in Italy is the food. I just love authentic Italian food, and you just can't beat like good pasta, and throw some prosciutto crudo with some fresh mozzarella and some tomatoes.
There's absolutely nothing like it. I've gotten to taste it myself once.
Italian food is like a religion over there. Like they've perfected it for generations, and it's unlike anything that, if Americans have never been to Italy and they think they know Italian food, they don't. Because it's hard to describe what it's like. And so I put together like a really authentic Italian food meal, and I'm set.
That's my answer.
Chocolate milk also is really good. Practice, post game, throw down a little chocolate milk is good.
Good one. Favorite jersey number? I already know this, but tell the people.
In college, I was 12, and then I moved to the national team, and Tom Hoffa was already 12. And so I couldn't take that. So I switched to 9 for no reason at all. oftentimes overseas, I couldn't take 9. So I would go to 2. So I've had a lot of different numbers, but I mean, we won gold in 9. So I'll take 9. Even though my wife hates odd numbers, like she has a phobia around odd numbers. And so she's like, I don't like your number. And I'm like, all right, sorry.
It just so happens that most of the really, really good players in the world right now all wear 9. Like Wilfredo Leon, wears 9. Ivan Zaitsev wears 9. Irvin Ingepet wears 9. Like, I don't understand why that.
There's 9 on the national team now. Do you know?
I don't think there is one.
Oh, really?
We don't really have a 9 right now. So some star is going to come.
That's mine. They should retire my jersey on the national team.
I would love to see that. What's the hardest position in volleyball? Unbiased.
Oh, course. Man. It's got to be either middle or setter. You could make an argument for all the positions because, you know, the outside's got to deal with passing, and they got to hit high balls, and right side, they got to deal with everything because they're getting everything, and they got to go bang their serve. But like we talked about earlier, the amount of information that middles have to compute in very short time frames is something that you can't replicate in other positions. And so the only thing that I would feel like could probably combat that is being a setter and just having to manage the game, which I think would be really difficult as well. But I'm going to put my 2 cents in for middles. It's just, I don't think you'll get a lot of pushback from people because they're like, I try to play middle and I can't, it's too hard. And I'm like, now, you know, Plus, you got to jump so much. That's why you don't see a lot of long-term career middles, because your body's destroyed. You've been jumping for 15 years and your body's like, okay, guy, like, settle down. Relax. Now it's time to... I always wondered when I played if I would, like, how healthy I would be after I was done playing. And it's funny because when you don't grind as much as you do at that level, you could probably imagine your body's just kind of like a collective sigh of relief.
And yes,
I feel pretty good now, as long as I'm not playing a lot. I've actually started to get back into playing a lot of beach volleyball. And
cool.
So my body's kind of like, hey, remember, like, we played a lot and you're old now. So I get all these aches and pains. And so, but anyways, yeah. Other than that, I feel pretty fortunate to have been able to be healthy throughout my career.
That is huge. Maybe not every middle would have thought this at the time, but when the libero position was invented, you might think now, cool, I don't have to play half the points. Great.
Right. You just got to jump twice as much. And so it evened out.
That's a good point. What's your favorite sports team of all time in any sport?
Oh man. Oh gosh, that's
a
tough one.
Could be a certain year or just like a team in general. Your call.
Well, I mean, I'll just go with the team in 08 just because of how tight we were as a team. Look, we weren't all friends. I think everyone will tell you that, but when it came to coming and getting the job done, like, I knew I could depend on that guy and all these guys. And that was a pretty special team.
Obviously,
you know, being able to do what we did, it was, it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, look, guys, we've gone through 2012, we've gone through 2016. It's not easy to win a gold medal. Like, there's some certain things that need to happen. And some of it oftentimes is even luck, and luck is outside your control.
Exactly.
So it's like, I don't know. It's unless you're Brazil in 04, who nobody was going to beat because they were playing the game at a different level than everybody else. Like, everybody that wins a gold, there's a little bit of luck involved. And are you going to be on the right side or the wrong side of history? And because it's a ball or two here or there, and that determines whether you're an Olympic champion or you're even getting a medal. So,
very well said. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
I've asked my wife this, and she's like an academic. She has a PhD. So her superpower would be, she always tells me, it would be that she instantly remembers everything she reads. I'm like, that sounds like a true person that is only interested in learning everything.
A very academic answer. That would be pretty nice, though.
My superpower, here's how logical I am. My superpower would be the ability to create superpowers. That way I can have all superpowers.
Dang it. I forgot to exclude that loophole. Good one. What sport are you the second best at other than volleyball?
I'm gonna put beach volleyball aside.
Yeah.
I'm gonna put beach volleyball aside because I'm still saying that's volleyball, because that would be an easy one. But it's golf. My next best sport, if you can call it a sport, my next best athletic endeavor is golf. And I'm not great at golf, but you know, I'm decent.
I love
golf. Like a mid 80s guy.
Oh yeah, that's about where I am. I'm hugely into it.
Right? I'm right at that sweet spot where I'm like, not good enough to care, but good enough to know how to have fun. So
I should learn how to figure that out, or at least pick one of the two, either get better or just stop it, man. Golf's hard. Last but not least, what's a stronger feeling for you, loving winning or hating losing? I love this question.
Man, I think the true competitor will say it's about how much losing sucks. I think the not the fear of losing, but just the feeling of losing tends to drive you towards success, right? It's like, I hated losing. I still hate losing. I want to win everything that I do, even in my job now, or if I am doing anything, I don't want to lose. I want to win. And so I think it's the more of the feeling of losing drives you than just the thrill of winning. Because winning is typically the long road, the long result of a long journey.
Right.
Right. It's, you don't just get to win. Like, there's a lot that goes into winning. And so, but you do get to lose. And I'd rather control that destiny than try to control something that I don't get to control. And so I'd probably throw my ring in the losing hat.
That's a good way to put it. I've never heard that take on it before. And lots of people have agreed with you on this show that losing just really sucks that much more. So before we get you out of here, I want to let you now once again put on the podcast host hat just a little bit and talk a little about your experience hosting the show. CrossNet is a company that I just love. They have helped us out a little bit. I had Sujo on. They sent us a CrossNet to mess around with
when
we were in Phoenix, which was a blast. It's so cool. And they have so many awesome people on board that are doing a great service to marketing some volleyball related thing outside of the volleyball community, which is something that we as a sport have never been good at. So what are some of your thoughts on like what CrossNet's doing and what your experience with them has been so far?
Yeah, I mean, what they're building from a brand perspective is pretty inspiring as well. It's they're just blowing up and good for them. You know, they're putting together a really strong team just from an operations standpoint, not even just from a content and professional volleyball standpoint, which they also have a really good team. I mean, they got guys like Taylor Crabb and Trevor Crabb and Tri Bourne and Emily Stockman and Kim Schalk and all of these guys that are big names in the beach volleyball scene. And when they came to me first, you know, their story is pretty cool because it's like it's a pair of brothers and their best friend, right? And they're sitting at their home in Miami going, hey, like, we want to do something cool. We don't want to work at our dumb jobs anymore and have to like report to people. So let's create something. And then they're like, what if we created a new sport? And what if we, you know, made this cross between Foursquare and volleyball? And so they went and created a prototype, threw it up on the beach in Miami, started playing. They're not volleyball guys at all.
Right.
They don't know volleyball. They didn't grow up playing volleyball. They don't know anybody in the volleyball community. And so that was the main reason why I had Chris, who's one of the co-founders on my, I had a business podcast before the CrossNet podcast and I had him on the show and he figured out who I was. And he's like, man, like, we're really trying to get more involved in the volleyball community, but we don't know how to do that. We're not volleyball guys. And so would you be interested in hosting a podcast? And I'm like, yeah, because I kind of already at that point wanted, and this was like early 2020.
Okay.
And I wanted to kind of get back into the volleyball community a little bit more after a little bit of a break. And so that was a perfect opportunity for me. And, you know, they put their backing behind it and their creative services department, their marketing, and it's been really cool. I mean, the podcast numbers are just going like this. So, you know, it is a niche podcast. It's about volleyball. So if you don't know volleyball, it's probably not going to be your cup of tea because it's very volleyball heavy.
Oh yeah.
But that's okay because that's the market they want to be in right now. But CrossNet is not just a volleyball company. I mean, they're a lifestyle company and they want to be in everybody's backyard and they want to be in every high school gym. And because it's just a fun game, as you see all the videos that are being posted of people in their backyards or on the beach or wherever. And I tip my hat to those guys and I'm glad that they're partnering with us and the show has been a blast to do. And so all your listeners, make sure to search the CrossNet Volleyball Podcast and we'll pop right up. So
yes, please go check out Ryan's show on the CrossNet platforms. It's awesome. You've got some incredible guests. Like the Micah Christensen episode blew me away because he was telling you something about the way that he was changing his setting mechanics, like where
he was taking it to the
right,
side.
Where he took the ball kind of over his right shoulder when he back sets, which just blew me away. Like, how do you like technically as a setter at that level try to just decide to do something new like that? That was amazing. So you had Taylor Crabb on recently, which was amazing. So.
Yeah, Taylor was on. It was awesome talking to Marv Dunphy.
Yes.
I love talking to Marv. He and I go way, way back. And you know, and it's been great. It's so cool to connect with all these people in the community that have all these different perspectives and experiences and kind of tap into their journey and what it, you know, what it looks like. And to be a professional volleyball player, or to be a, you know, an NCAA coach, or to be a human performance psychologist that we've had on the show. We've had Team USA's team doctor on the show, yep, which was kind of cool to talk to Chris Couturis, who I've known a long time. And so we try to get a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different angles. Sometimes we'll do like a theme for a little while. Like we'll focus on beach volleyball if there's a lot of like beach volleyball going on, or if there's, you know, college volleyball is going on, we'll try to get college coaches on. We had Fred Chow, who's the head coach of Old Dominion University for the women's team, and this year was their first year in Division One, and so he's building a program from scratch on the women's side. And I thought,
what a task that is because
there's not a lot of women's volleyball, Division One women's volleyball programs that are just starting. There are a lot of Division One women's volleyball programs, but there aren't a lot of that are just starting. And so I thought he'd be really interesting to talk to, and it was interesting because he got to like design their gym and their practice facility. And I'm cool. Like, ooh, that's pretty cool.
That is cool. So, yeah. You got a lot of options when you start from scratch, I guess. Well, if you ever want anyone to come on and talk about commentating volleyball, which is, I think, something that needs to be talked about more, you now know where to find me.
Beautiful, man. We'll have you on.
Well, thank you, Ryan. Thank you so much, man. We loved having you on the show. This was awesome. I can't wait to get more CrossNet people involved. Like, I know the owners have hopped onto volleyball podcasts before, and I want to hear from those guys about kind of what they're doing in more detail and why their product is so cool and why getting the volleyball is so cool.
There's some cool things that you'll see coming up pretty soon from CrossNet that I'm privy of, insider information that I'm excited about that should be coming out pretty soon. So it's they're making moves, man. They're doing it the right way. They're investing back into the business,
right?
And they want to grow and they're growing like crazy. So good for them.
Yeah, good for them. Well deserved. A model for us VLA people to follow for sure, and we love those guys. Looking forward to getting more connected with them, and
totally,
yeah, that's about it, man. Thank you so much for hopping on. We appreciate the time. The people are gonna love one, man. Everyone follow Ryan, follow CrossNet, check out the podcast.
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram too, at RyanMillar9. So
please do that.
Alrighty.
All right, everyone, thanks for joining us. We will see you next week. Deep Corn will be back leading up to VLA Cup in a couple of weeks, which is a massive event. So we're excited about that. More coming. Stay tuned to VLA stuff as well. See you next time.